God marvelously at work when things seem hopeless. God marvelously at work when things seem hopeless. That, I would put it to you, is a fairly prominent biblical theme. And it's a theme then which I suggest is relevant to this passage that we're looking at this evening, Judges 14 verse 8 through to chapter 15 verse 8. And in particular then, there are two things here in this passage that I would like us to notice. And first of all this evening, a sequence which highlights that theme. A sequence which highlights that theme. So there's a lot happens in this passage that we're looking at this evening. There are a lot of twists and turns as the passage unfolds. But I suppose that if we stand back, it's really a sequence comprising two main events. First of all, Samson's wedding in Timnah and what follows from that. And then secondly, Samson's return to Timnah at the beginning of chapter 15 and what follows from that. That's basically the sequence here, those two main events. And each of those two main events ends then with Philistine fatalities. 30 in the first case, chapter 14, verse 19. And then an unspecified number in the second case, chapter 15, verse 8. And remember then that this is good. Philistine fatalities are the name of the game. The Philistines are the enemy that is cruelly oppressing Israel at this point. Samson is supposed to be causing Philistine fatalities. That's what God has raised him up for. That's his purpose of being, if you like, here on planet Earth. But this is the thing. In both halves of the passage then, you don't see Samson's victories coming. In both cases, prior to the victory, we hit a point in the narrative where things seem hopeless and where victory seems a very remote prospect. So let me show you what I mean by that. So the first point then, where things seem hopeless, is Samson losing the contest. Samson losing the contest. So the time for his wedding has arrived, and apparently the cultural expectation in Timnah is that he, the bridegroom, should be the host, kind of organizing and running this week-long celebration. Now, throughout these chapters, you don't really get the impression, do you, that small talk is Samson's thing. Whenever he speaks, he tends to do so fairly directly in a fairly economical fashion. Idle chit-chat about the weather probably didn't come naturally to Samson. And it may be then to avoid all of that that he initiates this contest involving the riddle. And so as a reader then, remember you felt great dismay in the first part of chapter 14, at Samson's determination to marry a Philistine, non-covenant woman. But then, of course, you've been hugely encouraged by verse 4, that through this situation, God is going to damage the Philistines. And as Samson now then airs this riddle and sets out the terms of this contest. And you know, of course, that the riddle is an absolute stinker. The Philistines can't possibly solve it, lacking as they do crucial background information. You're thinking, well, this must be it then. This must be how Yahweh is going to damage the Philistines through Samson's marriage. They are going to lose the contest and they're going to be dispossessed of 30 sets of clothing. And okay, that may not sound like the most earth-shattering thing to happen, but of course in a context an economic context in the ancient world where people didn't have wardrobes bulging with outfits like we perhaps do today, that will be a significant blow to the Philistines to have to give up all these clothes, as they put it themselves in verse 15. It will to some extent impoverish them. So this must be the victory then to which verse 4 seemed to be pointing. This is the victory that will kind of offset the tragedy of Samson's pagan marriage. 30 humiliated Philistines at that wedding having to take the very shirts off their backs and hand them over to Samson. That's what you're expecting as a reader. But then, of course, it all goes wrong. Using some threat tactics, the Philistines get the answer to the riddle. And verse 18 then represents a hugely depressing moment. Israel's deliverer has lost the contest. The one supposed to be vanquishing the Philistines can't even deprive them of some of their garments, it seems. And you can sense, can't you, the sheer jubilation in the enemy at this point. They're gloating over Samson there. The way that they don't actually come to him with the answer until the very last possible minute. The sun is going down on the seventh day to kind of make Samson's defeat even more crushing. And the way in which they answer him, not in a straightforward way, but with this smug riddle of their own. What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? I mean, things really do seem hopeless then here at verse 18. Samson's pagan marriage seems to have been an unmitigated disaster. After all, it hasn't lived up to the promise of verse 4. Now, in fact, it's a marriage horribly soured by distrust and recrimination. The woman, for her part, has betrayed Samson's confidence, and Samson, for his part, is now referring to her as my heifer, language no more complimentary then than it would be today. So that's where we're at in verse 18. And yet it's out of that bleak situation where things seem hopeless that, contrary to all expectation, victory and success spring to life. The Spirit of the Lord in verse 19 suddenly rushes upon Samson, and he gets the 30 sets of clothes that he owes the Philistines, not by taking a trip to Marks and Spencer's, but by striking down 30 Philistines. In fact, it's better than that. He doesn't simply strike down 30 Philistines in Timnah, he strikes them down in Ashkelon. Now, Ashkelon isn't like Timnah, an Israelite town that has been taken over by the Philistines. Ashkelon is Philistine heartland. Ashkelon is a Philistine city through and through. So this isn't Samson merely being opportunistic. This is him now going on the offensive, taking the battle to the Philistines. What a turnaround we have then. In fact, it kind of actually casts a whole new light on the material which we said a moment ago was so depressing. I mean, you go back to verse 18 and the Philistines' answer to the riddle, and we said they're gloating. The Philistines are having a laugh. What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? But you read it again now. And what is stronger than a lion? Well, there's an answer to that question, isn't there? Which the Philistines don't even know as they're saying it. Because they don't know how the original lion had been killed. They know the answer to the riddle, but they don't know how the lion had been killed. And what they're about to find out is that there is someone stronger than a lion. And it's Samson. And so it's the narrator who's having the laugh here, rather than the Philistines. And so that's the first point then, where things seem hopeless, but then God marvellously works, Samson losing the contest. And then the second point where things seem hopeless is what I'm going to call Samson marshalling the foxes. Samson marshalling the foxes. So the wedding then has ended, of course, rather abruptly. And it's only some time later that Samson returns at the beginning of chapter 15 to Timnah, and he does so because he wants to visit now his wife, as he thinks she is. There's this intriguing touch that he goes to visit her with a young goat. And if you read the commentators, they say it's his way of saying sorry for kind of having referred to her as his heifer. And being a bit of a rough and ready bloke, then he doesn't really get the whole flowers and chocolate thing, and so he opts for a young goat instead. I wonder whether, in fact, that interpretation is a little bit too positive. I mean, it reminds me here of Genesis chapter 38, one of the darkest chapters in the whole Bible, where you remember Judah sleeps with a prostitute, not knowing that that prostitute is his daughter-in-law, Tamar, who's in disguise. But remember the payment. The way he pays for her services is what? It's with a young goat, the exact same term that we have here. And it's interesting, too, that the language of verse 1 here, the language that Samson uses, is exactly the same language that we have at the beginning of chapter 16. So he says, I will go into my wife in the chamber, very overtly sexual language. And we're told at the beginning of chapter 16 that he goes and visits a prostitute and he went in to her. The same language. And so I'm not sure then that Samson here is apologizing for calling his wife a heifer. I think he may be demonstrating actually that he still regards her very much as his heifer, that is to say, as an object, a mere possession for him to get use out of, in this case, sexual use out of. And I've said before in this series, it is, I think, one of the kind of sub-themes of Judges, actually, the chaos, the dysfunctionality in the relationships between the genders. And here we have an example of that, I think, probably. Samson using his wife, as he thinks she is, as this object. Of course, it's one of the worrying features of our own day, isn't it? With the rise of pornography and sexting and all this kind of thing, young men kind of seeing that Samson-like approach to women as normal. We need to pray, don't we, against that? Pray for ministries like that of LoveWise. It's why in the next book of the Bible, the relationship between Boaz and Ruth, which takes place in this same period, is so refreshing, isn't it? Boaz, the model husband who doesn't use Ruth, but spreads his wings over her, to use the beautiful language of it, protects her and defends her in that godlike manner. But anyway, here Samson visits the house and is rejected, of course, by the father, turned away by the father. And so he resolves in verse 3 to really go this time for the Philistines. And then we have this incident with the foxes. And I guess then that as readers, we tend to regard this either on the one hand as quite amusing, him tying up all these foxes, or perhaps as quite objectionable, the cruelty that he's showing here to these animals. I think probably neither of those reactions is what the author here intends. I think rather he intends a sad reaction to this. I think we're supposed to see a comparison here with an earlier episode in the book of Judges, namely the Gideon episode. Do you remember how Gideon originally had a massive army of 300,000 soldiers, and then you remember how it was reduced to 300 soldiers. 300 soldiers to whom he gave torches. And here's Samson now. And he hasn't got 300 soldiers at his disposal. I mean, Samson is a lone ranger, isn't he? The Israelites, remember, they're not particularly interested in taking on the Philistines at all. That will become even clearer in next week's passage. The Israelites are just so apathetic. They just don't seem even to be all that bothered that they're under tyranny. So he hasn't got 300 soldiers at his disposal. All he has got is 300 foxes to whom he gives torches. The same word. He attaches these torches to their tails. That's why I'm using the word marshalling these foxes. This is his army. Normally you marshal troops. Well, these are Samson's troops. This is all he's got. I'm saying it's a pathetic moment. As Samson then, without any proper army, has instead to resort to these creatures. And you think, well, how is he going to achieve anything with an army of foxes? So it's another depressing moment where things seem hopeless. But again, you see, it's out of that bleak situation where things seem hopeless that, contrary to all expectation, victory and success suddenly spring to life, so that we end up in verse 8 with the Philistines incurring a great blow, to use the language of that verse. Interestingly, it's the same language that the narrators used back in chapter 11, verse 33, of Jephthah's subduing of the Ammonites. He dealt them a great blow. Now, in his case, he completely wiped them out. Now, the narrator can't be saying that here, because, of course, Samson is going to have further skirmishes with the Philistines, and even when Samson dies, the Philistines are not going to have been wiped out. Only David will do that many, many years later. But presumably, if the language is the same as in chapter 11, verse 33, we are talking about a significant defeat here of the Philistines in chapter 15, verse 8. Now, there's no reference to the Spirit of the Lord in this case, rushing on Samson. But clearly, we're meant to understand, again, a profound divine involvement here. I think, actually, the Gideon motif continues. It's interesting, isn't it, that what did Yahweh do in the case of Gideon? What did he do to defeat the enemy? Well, he turned the enemy on itself. Remember how in the night when the trumpets were blown and the jars broken, then the enemy, the Midianites, they took out their swords and started fighting against each other. What do we have here happening? We have the Philistines turning in on themselves and going and burning the house of a Philistine family there in Timnah. I think actually we may have that theme again of a kind of divinely created fear. We talked about that with Gideon, how the Lord seemed to just fill the Midianites with a sense of dread, so that when Gideon went and overheard that conversation in the tent, one guy's had a dream, that loaf rolling down the hill and crushing a tent, and the other guy immediately interprets that, this is Gideon. Well, why should it be Gideon? Why shouldn't it be the other way around? That it's the Midianites crushing the Israelites. Well, it seems that Yahweh has just filled the enemy with this mysterious sense of dread. And I wonder whether there's something like that going on here, actually, with the Philistines. Because it's interesting, when you go back to the wedding, that little touch in verse 11, that they gave Samson 30 companions. Now, why did they give Samson 30 companions? Is this just a cultural thing? This is what they did at weddings. Possibly. We can't rule that out. But it's interesting language, actually. In the Hebrew, it's not they brought 30 companions, it's they took 30 companions. It sounds, to use the language we used this morning, that they're kind of commandeering these people. They're just quickly grabbing some people to put with Samson. And I think it's at least possible that these are almost bodyguards rather than just kind of best men or something, or groomsmen or something like that. And that there's a fear of Samson, which isn't to do with him being this great Hulk, because as I said last week, I don't think there's any evidence he is this great Hulk. It's just a God-given fear. As he had done with the Midianites, so he does with the Philistines. It's interesting too, coming back to chapter 15, verse 8, that phrase, he struck them hip and thigh. No one knows exactly what that means. It's the only time the phrase is used in the Bible. But I wonder whether it's supposed to remind us of the way Samson had defeated the lion. And remember how he tore it to pieces. And perhaps we're given the idea here that Samson kind of tears these Philistines to pieces, almost limb by limb. so you have a great pile of hips and thighs at the end of this battle. And of course, it was the Spirit who had enabled Samson to do that with the lion, and so we're to infer it's the Spirit who enables him to do it with the Philistines here. And so again then, we have this thrilling turnaround. Things seem so depressing. Poor old Samson, all he has is an army of foxes. But then suddenly, everything changes, and Samson has won this great victory. And I'm not going to make any application then at this point, but I just wanted you to see then that this is a theme which is indeed being highlighted here in this sequence of events. God marvellously at work when things seem hopeless. But then, secondly then, so we've noticed a sequence which highlights that theme, but then secondly, notice with me a scene which heightens that theme. A scene which heightens that theme. And the scene to which I'm referring is the one with which our passage begins there in verse 8. Now, you might think that we've talked enough about this lion already. We talked about it a bit last week. And we're not flogging a dead horse, we're flogging a dead lion. But we are going to return to it just as we close this evening, because we have this new development, don't we, in verse 8, that there are these bees that are found then in the carcass of the lion. Now, just two or three remarks here, kind of as a build-up to what I really want to say about this. First of all, the presence of these bees is surprising. I think the narrator indicates that by that word, behold. He turned aside to see the carcass of the lion, and behold, there was a swarm of bees in the body of the lion. One of the commentators remarks, for all whose eyes are open, this sight bears the signature of God. Bees do not normally inhabit cadavers. Flies and maggots do. Apparently this carcass dehydrated quickly, bypassing putrefaction, and in no time at all provided a hospitable environment for bees not only to live, but also to produce their honey. So that's one thing to notice. Secondly, the narrator refers here rather oddly to a congregation of bees. That's the literal Hebrew word that he uses. It's not swarm. We have words in the Hebrew Bible for swarm when it is referring to insects and things, but the word that's used here is the word that usually in the Hebrew Bible is used of Israel, the congregation of Israel. You find that phrase often, and it's this word that we have here, which the ESV translates swarm. And then a third thing, this lion surely is a natural picture of Samson himself. I mean, a lion, not necessarily this lion, but a lion is a natural picture of Samson himself. Now last week I said that a lion kind of pictures that morally wild streak, the flesh, if you like, that is within Samson. That's not what I'm talking about now. I just mean Samson himself. I mean, the lion's referred to, isn't it, in verse 14 of chapter 14, in the riddle, it's referred to by that title, the strong. Out of the strong came something sweet. And you could equally use that phrase to describe Samson. Again, not because I think necessarily he was just a naturally strong guy, but certainly whenever the Spirit came on him and used him, you could describe him then as Samson the strong. And the word strength is used in connection with Samson. Delilah keeps asking, what is the secret of your great strength, later on. So here then, we have this, here in verse 8, we have this strong one, the lion, and yet it's not in the exercise of its strength, but in its death, that it brings life and flourishing conditions to this congregation of bees. And I wonder then, is that perhaps a pointer to how this whole story is going to end in chapter 16? With the strong one, Samson, in his pathetic death under a pile of rubble, breaking the Philistine grip and thus bringing life and flourishing conditions to the congregation of Israel. And indeed, can we perhaps even go further still and say that this is a pointer to a greater story altogether, and the way in which many centuries later, the strong one, Jesus, the lion of the tribe of Judah, in his pathetic death on a Roman cross, would break the powers of darkness and thus bring life and flourishing conditions to the entire congregation of God's people. And so you see then how this theme is gloriously heightened, I think, in this little scene in verse 8. God marvellously at work when things seem hopeless. You couldn't get more hopeless than the carcass of a lion, a dead lion like there on the ground. But in a dead lion, in a dead Samson, in a dead Jesus, God so marvellously at work. And perhaps, in fact, we can go further still and say that the lion is pointing even beyond Jesus, pointing forward to Christians like Stephen, for instance, who died such a pathetic death, and yet through whose death such life burst forth. The gospel going to new places, Saul of Tarsus becoming a Christian and the greatest missionary the church would ever have. Christians like Paul himself, who writes, you remember, in 2 Corinthians 4:12 to those Corinthians, "Death is at work in us, in me and my colleagues, but life is at work in you." In other words, as we suffer, as we're battered, as we're persecuted, as we're hounded and harassed, it's bringing life and flourishing conditions to you Christians. You're hearing the gospel, you're growing in the gospel. And we see the same thing in our world today, don't we? In parts of the world where Christians are suffering greatly, Christians are being killed. It's the dead lion thing again. Such apparent hopelessness, and yet so often God is marvellously at work in those situations, and through the blood of the martyrs, the church is growing and advancing. You see, Jesus wasn't just talking about himself, was he, when he said in John 12:24, "Unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit." Here's this lion in death bearing much fruit. Samson in death bearing much fruit. Jesus supremely in death bearing much fruit. But it's the pattern for Christians as well, for Stephen, for Paul, for us. Not perhaps at that same dramatic level. We may not be persecuted like Stephen and Paul were. But is it not the case that if God is going to use us and make us fruitful, he will probably make us weak in order to do so? So that we will have to say like Paul, "When I am weak, then I am strong." It's so often in frustration and toil and apparent futility and hopelessness that God uses us. We think, well, it's when I'm at my best and my most impressive and my slickest that I will be most fruitful for the Lord. And so often it's not like that. And it's when we're at our lowest and our weakest and we're feeling most overwhelmed that God makes us fruitful. And so let's grasp this theme and look for this theme to be outworked even in our lives. God marvellously at work when things seem hopeless. Amen.